We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Untangle, the meditation podcast from Gaiam. I'm your host, Patricia Karpus. In this series, we introduce you to real people with extraordinary stories and experts who have devoted their lives to teaching and helping others through meditation. In today's episode, I sat down with Judson Brewer. Judson is a thought leader with a particular focus on how we can conquer our addictions using mindfulness training. He was the medical director of the Yale Therapeutic Neuroscience Clinic and is now director of the University of Massachusetts Center for Mindfulness, where he's also associate professor of psychiatry and medicine. Judson shares how mindfulness fits into the addiction cycle and how it can help change our unwanted behaviors and habits. Here's his story. Judson, I'm so happy to have you here today. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You have been studying mindfulness for 15 years, is that right, or longer?
I got into it about 20 years ago and have been researching it for over a decade now.
So what was your original inspiration for getting into mindfulness? Was there a personal trigger of some sort? Do you have a long and lofty childhood to share?
Suffering. You know, it's funny. I was kind of had my dream world all set after, you know, graduated from college with my college sweetheart. And we had, we were both going to start the same MD-PhD program together at Washington University in St. Louis. And we broke up the summer right before starting medical school. So was having, you know, that wasn't part of the plan.
Yeah, so was it devastating? Was that the first time that life had sort of thrown you a little bit of a curveball?
I think I was a little stressed my senior year of college. I actually had symptoms, which I later probably self-diagnosed as irritable bowel syndrome. You know, I was like, oh, I can't be stressed out because I, you know, I play the violin, I run, I backpack, I do all this stuff.
Yeah, but you were stressed out.
I was, you know, pretty type A, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And starting medical school, the breakup was actually a good thing for both of us. And yet I was having trouble sleeping for the first time, probably in my life.
In medical school?
Right, or at the beginning, right before I started medical school. And so at the beginning of medical school, this Jon Kabat-Zinn book landed in my lap, Full Catastrophe Living, and I started reading it before medical school started, and I started listening to the cassette tapes. There were cassette tapes back then. Back right at the beginning of medical school. So my first day of medical school, I was thinking, well, this is a new start to my life. Let's try out something new. And I started meditating that first day.
You just started meditating. You read the book and you listened to the cassette and you started meditating.
Yeah, I started, well, officially I started listening to the cassettes and falling asleep regularly in the morning.
So you fell asleep when you were doing your first meditation.
Oh yeah, probably for the first 6 months.
But you still loved it and you stuck with it.
Well, I'm kind of that, you know, I like, you know, if you're going to do something, do it. You know, there's this saying, go big or go home.
Right, right.
So I was like, I'm going to do this. And so I just kept doing it.
Well, I guess if you were having trouble sleeping and then you were sleeping during your meditations, that was helpful.
It's getting my sleep in somewhere, yes.
So then you kept doing it. After 6 months, you were doing breath work, which is mindfulness-based meditation.
I started with breath work, and I also noticed that during boring medical school lectures, I could pay attention to my breath and do something useful.
So you, when you pay attention to your breath and you're in a medical school class, you're not paying attention. It's not like a way to be present to the lecture. It's a way to...
It's a way to
stay
pay
awake.
Attention to something.
Right.
But not the lectures. Yeah, right. It wasn't helping me learn the material better.
But you became committed to your own mindfulness practice, and you were certainly committed to Jon Kabat-Zinn. He became one of your teachers. Is that right? Or
I got a teacher in the Midwest after starting to go on week-long retreats. There was a woman, Ginny Morgan, who was this wonderful teacher who was teaching in Columbia, Missouri. Just fabulous, fabulous teacher. And so I started working with her, started going to weekly meditation groups in St. Louis, and just the practice really flourished for me. I mean, it was just the right time to be doing this.
Right, right. And so what kinds of changes did you see in your own personal practice that then led you to want to create a profession based on these foundations?
For the first 8 years or so, I had no intention of doing research in mindfulness. I was a molecular biologist interested in neuroscience, really trying to figure out why we get sick when we're stressed out, you know. But I was working with animal models. I was making conditional knockout mice, looking at genetics differences, you know, and how those were affected. You know, if we knocked out stress hormone receptors, for example, how they would affect immune system development and function. So I was just meditating as a way to get by, and I was finding that I was less stressed, I was able to be more focused. My relationships with other people were improving, you know, I was a little less self-centered. And so just seeing a lot of benefit for myself and for others.
What shifted when you decided to make this a lifelong passion? You started looking at addiction, triggers, and stress.
It's funny, in these MD-PhD programs, you get, you know, 8 years, and the first 2 years are medical school, and then you do your PhD for as long as it takes. So you get 4 or 5 years to forget everything you've learned in medical school.
Right, right.
And then you have to go back and start right on the wards where you're seeing patients. So I was a little nervous to try to remember all of my medical school interviewing skills, so I decided to do psychiatry is my first rotation back, so I could remember how to interview. And I figured, well, I'm never going to be a psychiatrist, so, you know, you chalk this one up for learning. And I went through that rotation and was just blown away by how people were suffering in the same way that my mind was starting to see the origins of suffering through what I'd been learning through looking at my own mind and also understanding the psychology behind it. And so I was thinking, wow, this is great. I can't wait until I do my other medical school rotations because I'm sure they'll be even better. And of course they weren't. I needed to be.
This was interesting.
Yeah. Well, it was not only interesting, but it just really grabbed me. It was like, oh, I have to do this. You know, and in particular, when I went into residency training and I started working with people with addictions, I noticed that they were speaking the same language as the Buddhists. You know, craving, clinging, suffering. And I said, oh, wait a minute, this is not a coincidence.
So from a brain perspective, you talk about the origins of suffering. Do you think of that from a brain perspective, or do you think of that from another perspective?
I now think about it from a brain perspective, but I wasn't thinking about it from a brain perspective at the time. I was just following what the data were showing. So I started learning how to do clinical research with addictions and simply asking questions such as, you know, how does mindfulness affect people's ability to not relapse to drug and alcohol use? So started doing clinical research there during residency training, mm-hmm. and found that mindfulness training, and I was, you know, at that point I'd been practicing about 10 years at that point myself. So I actually delivered the training myself so I could really see how people were responding or not. It gave me the opportunity to really step back and look to see how people were or were not benefiting from mindfulness training. And at the time, there weren't any published randomized controlled trials comparing mindfulness to gold standard therapy as a first line treatment. So it was an opportunity to really see how well this stuff worked. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we found that in our first, you know, it was a small pilot study, but we found that compared to cognitive behavioral therapy, it was as good as gold standard. That's one of the gold standards. And we also found that mindfulness training helped prevent people from getting caught up in stress responses. So we would give them personalized stressors and see how their physiology and their psychology responded, whether they were resilient to stress or not.
But you're doing that in a controlled environment. So does that trick the system at all?
It helps to, I mean, that controlled environment helps us have more objective data to see how well, you know, how well these treatments are actually doing. And I didn't run the laboratory portions, which would also decrease the bias.
When you talk about addiction, can you explain it? Because I think of addiction, there being a spectrum of addiction. There are people that are addicted to non-harmful bad habits, and then there are people that are addicted to very harmful bad habits. And how do you think about that?
I think of addiction along a spectrum, a learning continuum, really. And so if you think of the simplest things like getting caught up in something. Mm-hmm. So let's say we get caught up in a daydream. You know, you get caught up and then somebody says, hey, snap out of it, and you snap out of it. So there's a little bit of caught upness, but not much. Mm-hmm. Stress, boy, wouldn't it be great if we could say, hey, snap out of it, right? So we get caught up a little bit more, and then on that far end of the spectrum is addiction. So one of the simplest definitions is continued use despite adverse consequences. So if we're so caught up in a behavior that we're continuing to do that behavior knowing that it's bad for us, that's really where the addiction piece comes in, despite adverse consequences. So you can think of it as continuing to drink, continuing to smoke, continuing to use drugs, or even continuing to text while we're driving, knowing that it's not good for us, but getting caught up in it nonetheless.
And we'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
And then the adverse consequences, is it the more severe they are, the more difficult it is to stop the addiction? Or how does that work?
Not necessarily. It's hard to stop things based on our own psychology, physiology, and brain.
But a lot of people talk about like alcoholism as being a chemical problem. What does that mean when they say that? Like, what is the difference between a physical craving for a cigarette or for another glass of wine versus, you know, what's going on in your brain? Like, how do you separate the physical
versus
and the brain?
The psychological.
Yeah, versus the psychological in your studies and your thinking.
So if you think of alcohol, for example, mm-hmm. alcohol is a physical substance that has physiologic effects on the body. So it gets absorbed into the bloodstream, it goes and affects certain receptors in the brain, the GABA receptors in particular. And it also induces dopamine release in the brain. You take that chemical, you put it into your body, and it affects your body physically. And it causes a number of changes in the brain. So we get up and down regulation of receptors based on the amount of the substance that's in the body. So we can have physical dependence upon a certain substance. Mm-hmm. We can have physical dependence on alcohol. We can have physical dependence on nicotine. So when we stop smoking, for example, we can start to get withdrawal symptoms. And they're well-characterized physical withdrawal symptoms because our brain is screaming out saying, hey, where's my, you know, you're not binding my receptor like you used to.
What is a receptor? Let's explain to the audience, what is a receptor?
A receptor is basically a protein on a cell surface that receives, I guess that's why it's called receptor,
right.
It receives some type of a ligand, something that binds to it, mm-hmm. and then triggers a signaling in the cell.
So this is the physical brain connection that you have this, what feels like a physical craving.
Well, I would say physical dependence.
Physical dependence.
Because we're physically dependent upon those things. And I would say it's not just limited to the brain. We have all sorts of receptors in our gut and all over our body that have, you know, effects that, then go and have downstream effects on the brain.
On the brain. And then, and that's what you study, is all of these downstream effects on the brain.
I study them in one particular aspect. We don't look as much molecularly in my lab. We look more at the behavioral spectrum and more in the psychological end of things. So if in contrast to the receptors, we can also have psychological cravings. So let's say, let's take sugar, for example.
Okay.
So sugar is known to cause dopamine release in the brain. We can also have dopamine release in anticipation of eating sugar or in anticipation of smoking a cigarette. So we get a psychologically induced release of chemicals in our brain. So there, that's where the psychology is different than the physical. You're not putting something physically into your body, yet psychologically you're seeing, you know, chemicals released based on, you know, basically based on how we've learned to expect things.
So does that make you want it more, crave it more when you have that sort of pre-dopamine release?
The dopamine release seems to be associated with the formation of craving and also the formation of habits around behavior. So it seems that it gets, you know, when we get a reward, at first we get dopamine release as part of that. And drugs in particular can specifically cause dopamine release or increase dopamine in the synapses where the receptors are. So we start to learn, oh, if I take cocaine, for example, then I'm going to get this dopamine rush. Eventually that moves to anticipating when we think about or see cocaine or see people that we use cocaine with or alcohol or mm-hmm. heroin or any other drug of abuse. Those anticipatory responses are our body saying, hey, I'm about to get what is, you know, quote unquote good.
Mm-hmm.
So we can get that craving that gets us ready to start using the drug.
But it's incomplete because you haven't done the drug yet.
Right.
You're having that. And that's the same with food. That's the same with cigarettes.
Yeah.
So how do we retrain ourselves to intercept that?
Well, the first step in retraining is really thoroughly understanding the process.
Mm-hmm.
So we can understand it from a brain perspective. We can also understand it from a psychological perspective. And this is where the first work that we were, the work that we were doing in the clinic to look to see psychologically what was happening was really helpful for us before we then moved into the brain. So for example, we had a study where we had compared mindfulness training to the American Lung Association's freedom from smoking for a smoking cessation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We found that the mindfulness training was twice as good at the end of treatment and five times as good at a four-month follow-up, you know, five times better, I should say, than the gold standard treatment. So we were seeing some behavioral effect, and we said, okay, what's actually happening here mechanistically? Let's figure out what's going on.
Right, right.
So we started to look, and we looked at the mechanisms that had been well established in smoking and mm-hmm. The formation of smoking. And it seems that we've learned to smoke through positive and negative reinforcement. So we see a cue, our brain says, oh, that looks good, and that cue, you know, or let's use something concrete. Let's say we eat a good meal. We want that good feeling to continue. So we smoke a cigarette to, you know, as a dessert or after meal cigarette. And then our brain says, oh, that's good. You know, you do that again. So we form that positive loop
mm-hmm.
where we associate meals with smoking cigarettes. We can do the same thing in a negatively reinforcing way. Let's say that our boss yells at us and our brain says, oh, that doesn't feel very good. It says, well, why don't you go out and smoke a cigarette because you'll feel better.
Oh.
We go out and smoke, we feel better. So that negative reinforcement, so we're removing something that's unpleasant for us.
Yeah.
You know, removing that getting yelled at or that stressful feeling by smoking a cigarette. Now we start to associate removal of the negative with smoking.
So how do you replace that habit or intercept that loop that you're talking about? And so how do people actually quit? Because rewards are so nice. I like rewards.
Yeah, rewards, rewards are rewarding. Now, if you understand the process, you can look to see how, so there are some typical treatments. For example, if you avoid the stimuli, then you're less likely to use. So people are encouraged to avoid bars if they drink.
Oh, okay.
And avoid people that they drink with. So it makes sense because you're less likely to have the stimulus go into the loop. If you smoke cigarettes, it's a little harder to avoid your car, your front porch, outside of work and all that. So one of the treatments is to provide a substitute strategy. So if you chew on your pen cap, take deep breaths, eat candy, whatever, you can start to, anytime you have a craving to smoke a cigarette, you can replace that behavior with another behavior, such as chewing on your pen cap. The problem there, and these strategies haven't been shown to be great overall, the problem there is that you don't actually dismantle that core addictive loop in itself. You're just treating around it. So providing...
You're just replacing the addiction.
Right. So this is where, that's the first step, is if we can really understand how the addiction is formed, then we can say, well, what will actually dismantle this at its core?
Mm-hmm.
And when we looked at our data, we found that the people who were using mindfulness training, they were still craving at the end of treatment. But as they quit, that craving eventually died down over time. And when we did all the fancy math and all that to figure out what was going on, we found that the mindfulness training was informally moderating the decoupling of craving and smoking. In other words, people were still having a craving, but they didn't automatically smoke.
Well, they didn't go straight to the reward. What was the loop that they did instead of going straight to the reward?
Well, that's the difference here, is they weren't actually doing anything else.
Okay.
They were just noticing that they could have these cravings. They could be with the craving and not succumb to the smoking.
That sounds like the hardest thing of all in addiction is to recognize it. Like you talk about, recognize, allow it to be there, investigate it, or be curious about it, and just note that it's there. That seems to take such a calmness and discipline to be able to go through that process versus the strong cravings that come with food or alcohol or cigarettes.
It's not easy.
It's a lot of practice.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's not easy, but there are a couple of tricks that can help along the way. And the first is, and this seems really crazy to a lot of people, we say, you know what, just go ahead and smoke. And they look at us like we're crazy.
Right. This is a stop smoking program.
Right. So they go ahead and smoke, and we say, okay, just pay attention as you smoke. And what they realize is that smoking doesn't taste very good. It actually tastes pretty bad. So they start to become disenchanted with that behavior from the beginning without us having to do anything cognitive. Because we're trying to avoid the cognitive part of the brain because that part of the brain is unreliable.
Mm.
It goes offline when we get stressed out. So we can't trust it.
Right.
So instead of trusting this thinking part of our brain where we know that smoking is bad for us, we know that addictions are bad for us, we say, let's tap into the more emotional part. Well, when you look at, and we really pay attention and smoking doesn't taste very good, that's emotional. You're like, oh yeah, this isn't very good. And people start to become disenchanted with the behavior, which gives them the momentum to move forward.
Mm.
As they move forward, then we can teach them another thing, which is, what does a craving actually feel like? I had a patient who came into my office who said, you know, I feel like if I don't smoke, my head will explode. Literally. And I said, okay, well, when your head does explode, just put the pieces back together and call me and we'll document this as the first case of craving-induced head exploding. Yes. So all joking aside, what he could start to see as we explored this together, if he could recognize the craving, not push it away, and instead of pushing it away, get curious. Investigate, what does this feel like in my body? Suddenly he's putting on his Sherlock Holmes cap and saying, oh, what does this feel like? Mm-hmm. When we're curious about something, what does that feel like? Does that feel pleasant or unpleasant?
It feels pleasant. It's interesting.
Yes. So we can flip the valence from an unpleasant craving to, oh, what does this feel like in my body? So people can learn to be with these cravings and notice that they are just tightness or tension or heat or restlessness.
This seems like it's very similar to the foundational concepts of mindfulness, because we learn to be present with what's ever happening and allow ourselves to be with that without judging it and without ruminating in it and without reacting to it, but having a choice about how we respond. And it seems like, in a way, you are describing that process.
In every way as clearly as possible. Yes, this is exactly what mindfulness is about.
Right.
This is not something different than mindfulness. This is not something that we came up with. This is where I looked at my own practice. I looked at my teachers. I looked at the early suttas and I said, wait a minute, this is how it works.
Right, and I can apply it to these conditions. And so when you look at addiction, and we were talking here about cravings for cigarettes because you have an app called Craving to Quit, but you've also done work with eating disorders and mindful eating and other areas of addiction as well.
We have, and I run an addiction clinic here at UMass. But in particular, we've worked with craving for cigarettes with the Craving to Quit program. And over the last couple of years, we've pilot tested what we're calling Eat Right Now, as in eat correctly in the present moment. But that program is interesting because it kind of was born out of the Craving to Quit program. We had a pilot tester who said, and this was back when we didn't even have videos, and she was just reading my scripts. And she said, you know what, I'm changing the way I'm eating now just based on these smoking scripts. And I said, well, that's interesting. Because I didn't know anything about eating at that point, except that I liked to eat. And I said, wait a minute. And this was back when the literature was just starting to emerge around stress and emotional eating being similar in behavior as addictions. So I wrote out some scripts, started pilot testing it with early users, and then for the last 2 years I've been using it in my clinic, where I had daily short bites of mindfulness training that that my patients would get, and then we would come together as a group each week and see how they were doing. And as you can imagine, we don't have to smoke to survive, but we do have to eat. So this was an added challenge that was just really fascinating to explore, where we could see, can these same principles apply to stress eating? And lo and behold, yes, they can. One thing that we learned was that people who stress eat have learned or have unlearned the ability to tell the difference between stress-induced craving for food and physiologic-induced craving for food. So they would just eat anytime they had this urge to eat. So we could start to disentangle, this is what stress craving feels like, and this is what physiologic hunger feels like.
So talk about the differences between them.
Well, it's interesting because there are a number of symptoms that are, that you can find in the psychological literature saying, for example, restlessness. Restlessness can be a symptom of, I think, both stress and hunger. So there are a number of symptoms that have overlap, and there are some symptoms that don't have any overlap. So some, for example, are only due to stress and some that are only due to hunger. So we actually developed an algorithm where people could check off how many, I have this symptom, I'm restless, my stomach's growling, which is probably hunger as compared to stress.
Right.
I have this, I have this, I have this. And then we can ask them, well, how long ago did you eat? And we can start to weight their answers based on how long ago they ate. So if they just ate a few minutes ago, then these symptoms were leaning more towards stress. If they ate a long time ago, we could say, well, you might be hungry because you haven't eaten in 6 hours. So we can help people differentiate that stress from the hunger. And then we can also give them the tools to start to bring mindfulness to every aspect of eating.
What are some of the cases that you've worked with where you've seen the most dramatic positive results?
We've seen, most recently, we've been working with folks with stress eating. And I've seen, in my clinic, I've seen some dramatic results where I've been referred a lot of patients with severe binge eating disorder who've been binging for, one patient in particular. I think she started when she was about 7 or 8. She started eating when her mom was basically mentally abusing her and was eating to numb her mind and to comfort herself. And, I think she was about 30, say early 30s now. And she was binging on an entire piece at a time, and she binged for 20 out of 30 days in a month. And she started, you know, learning mindfulness as a way to get her relationship back where she was more in control. And by the end of treatment, she was, she said, you know, I can eat a single piece of pizza and actually enjoy it. She said, I got my life back.
And it was because of her mindfulness practice, and she was paying more attention to the whole process of the...
Well, she could see clearly that the binge, she felt terrible after binging, not only physically, but psychologically, because she beat herself up. It was only a temporizing measure because she would numb herself while she was eating, but then as soon as she stopped eating, those thoughts would come flooding back and more, because then she could beat herself up over binging. She knew that it was bad for her and all of this stuff.
Well, that's the other question is, you talk about the rewards, and the rewards are, you know, you have this dopamine release when you binge eat or you drink alcohol or you smoke cigarettes, but then you have the consequence afterwards. It's like that surge, that sugar surge, and then you come down afterwards because you feel horrible. It's that shame that's associated with that behavior.
Well, I'll add another aspect, which is that we often mistake this excitement for happiness.
Ah, right.
And nobody...
It's like an adrenaline rush.
Yes, nobody teaches us that there might actually be greater levels of happiness that have nothing to do with excitement. How about joy? How about peace? How about, you know, unconditional love? That's unconditional.
Right.
It doesn't depend on getting something.
You mentioned in a workshop that I was lucky enough to take with you, you talked a little bit about Facebook addictive disorder, which I'm very curious about because I think we're so addicted to technology in general, and we probably don't have to explain why. But how does that happen, and how do we change, and why should we change?
Well, it's interesting, Facebook, and you know, I think Mark Zuckerberg and his friends kind of fell into this perfect storm in terms of how we learn and something that society was hungering for. So if you look at it, there are studies now that show that we get the same type of dopamine release when we self-disclose as when we use drugs of abuse.
So self-disclose, share?
Yeah, basically talk about ourselves.
Okay, okay. That feels good?
It feels rewarding, let's
Whether
say.
Somebody's listening or not, is it rewarding?
Well, it's probably more, so for example, if we post something on Facebook, you just people can walk through this thought experiment themselves. They post something on Facebook and they're sitting there restless waiting for that first like. That restlessness is like somebody waiting for that next hit of drug. And then they get that hit and then get the dopamine surge and, oh yeah, where's my next hit? Where's my next hit? So that type of reinforcement process, how it happens in the same way as learning to take drugs. Now, there are other sticky aspects of social medias, not only talking about ourselves, but the gossip factor, you know, where we get to learn about other people. That's kind of sticky as well.
Are we comparing ourselves more?
Well, the comparison is also a stick, you know, it also has that caught up quality to it. Mm-hmm. So the comparison's big in both in positive and negative ways, you
Fear
know, better than, worse than, same as.
Yeah.
And also the third element is intermittent reinforcement. So you never know when somebody's going to like your Facebook feed. So every time somebody likes it, you know, they click the like button. We don't know when that's going to happen. So we get this unexpected reward. And that's how dopamine works, is it fires when something when we get an unexpected reward.
Mm. So let's talk about like teenagers or, you know, 10, 11, 12 year olds who are growing up with this behavior for the first time. I mean, for most of us that are over 40, et cetera, we didn't grow up with this. So we maybe have a little more control over how we use it. But what do you think is happening with this generation?
Yeah, it's one wild and crazy experiment.
Yeah, right. Do you test the brains of this group?
Well, there are people that are following adolescents as they develop. Yeah. And one of the very interesting questions, or potentially scary questions, is, you know, the adolescent brain doesn't fully develop, you know, until at least the age of, say, 25, roughly speaking. And so there's, you know, adolescents tend to be more impulsive than adults and all this. This is the pre-pruning process where it's before the brain has kind of locked habits into place.
Yeah.
So if we're doing a bunch of things like this and we start locking Facebook into our brain, by the time we go through college and later, then this type of behavior gets more locked in.
Thank you so much. It was so insightful. I feel so grateful for being able to talk to you today.
It's my pleasure. I love this work.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Judson, and thank you all for listening. We look forward to sharing more inspiring stories on our next episode. If you'd like to know more about Judson, check out his website at judsonbrewer.com, where you can hear his TED Talks and read his studies. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at untangle@guyam.com. And don't forget to check out Meditation Studio by Guyam in the App Store. See you next time.